We're going to go ahead and get started this morning. We'll be in Deuteronomy and the 27th chapter to start with, and we're going to go fairly quickly again today like we did last Sunday, looking at the last chapters of the book. And then next Sunday, we're going to begin a study with a booklet that's in the back there next to the handouts for today's lessons. So if you don't have the Deuteronomy lessons for today, they're back there by the bulletin. And next to them is the book we're going to be studying next quarter, which will be about biblical authority. But it's not going to be a let's study this issue and let's study that issue kind of study. When you look through the book, you'll see that it's more about defining the word authority in the first place, looking at why God and Jesus have that authority, where we learn that authority from, and what it teaches us. And so we'll begin that study next Sunday, and if you would like a copy of the book, it is there in the back. And my understanding is it's yours to keep, and so you can write in it and make notes in it, and all of that good stuff. And just as a kind of reminder about everything we've seen so far in Deuteronomy, we've gone through the preamble where we had just the introduction of when this book was presented to the people, when they were hearing these words of Moses presented to them, then the historical lead up to the events in Deuteronomy there in chapters 1 through 4. Chapters 5 through 11 are the general stipulations of the law, and then we had the specific stipulations given from chapter 12 to 26, the largest portion of the book where God, through Moses, gives his specific commands regarding how the people were to live in their covenant with him. Because remember that Deuteronomy is based on the framework of what's known as a suzerain vassal treaty, where God is what is called a suzerain, or the all-powerful king, and his conquered people, Israel, are the vassals to him in this scenario. And so this Sunday, we're going to look at the last two parts of the outline of how that kind of a treaty would have been written. There are blessings and curses in chapters 27 and 28 that are laid forth about what will happen if the people are faithful to keep all of the laws that he has given, and if they fail to keep it, what he will do to punish them for that. And then there are the witnesses called at the end of the book in 29 through about 33 or 32, depending on the way you want to break it down, where different things or people or gods would be called to bear witness in this kind of a treaty. Well, here God is the one bearing witness through Moses, through what he calls the Song of Moses, to the people that he is just if he does punish them for breaching the covenant with him. And then chapters 33 and 34 make up the kind of conclusion of the book, where we have the account of Moses' death and the transition of leadership to Joshua before they go to enter the land. So in chapter 27, the people have heard the law, and at the end of 26, Moses has told them that they were to this day keep the commandments that the Lord their God had given them, or Yahweh their God had given them. They should be diligent to keep them because, as he says at the end of the chapter previous to 27, he has made them high above all the nations, and he is their praise, and they are to be his praise and their name, and he is their honor, and they are to be a holy people to Yahweh their God. And so then Moses and the elders of Israel at the beginning of 27, there in verse 1, command the people to keep all the commandments that I command you this day. And it shall be on the day when you shall pass over the Jordan, that the land that Yahweh your God is giving you, that you shall set up for yourself great stones and plaster them with plaster. You shall write upon them all the words of this law when you pass over, that you may go into the land that Yahweh your God is giving you, a land flowing with milk and honey, as Yahweh, the God of your fathers, has promised you. And it shall be when you have passed over the Jordan that you shall set up these stones, which I command you this day on Mount Ebal. And you shall plaster them with plaster, and there you shall build an altar to Yahweh your God, an altar of stones. You shall lift up no iron upon them. You shall build the altar of Yahweh your God of unhewn stones, and you shall offer burnt offerings upon it to Yahweh your God. And so when they cross over, they are to do this. Why? Why would it be important for them to make this pillar of stones with plaster on it, with the law written on it, and then to build this altar to God of unhewn stones and to offer him burnt offerings and peace offerings when they enter the land. Okay, so for the future generations, this is going to serve as a monument or memorial to them, to be a reminder to them of what God has called them to do. But in a more immediate context, why would it be important for them when they have first crossed over the Jordan to do this? What is it a sign of to God if they were to do this from the very outset of entering the land of promise? Of obedience. It was their way of showing that as they enter the land, from the very first moment, they would serve the Lord alone and worship him alone. And so the priests and Moses then take over teaching the people, calling them to listen, that they will be careful to keep the statutes and commandments of God. And so Moses then begins to tell them, with the Levites, what the curses of the covenant are. And so he goes through from verse 15 through the end of this chapter in verse 26, and he is telling them, cursed is, cursed is. Why is God telling them about these things first? Why do the curses come before the blessings of the covenant? Right, so you lead with the bad news. You get it out of the way. So if they fail to be obedient to God once they've crossed into the land, he tells them these are the things or the kinds of things that will happen to you. So he says, cursed is the man who makes an idol or molten image, an abomination to the Lord, the works of the hands of craftsmen, and sets it up in secret. And then all of the people respond. So this is a call and response kind of thing. The priests and Moses would say this loudly to the gathered people, and the people would reply with the word, amen. And what does that word mean? So be it, or true. And so they're saying, we agree. We accept this as a curse. If we set up a molten image, we will be a curse on the land. And so he goes through and he uses different examples of the things that would make you cursed under the law. And so another example, verse 18, cursed is he who misleads a blind person on the road. Why is that a specific curse that's laid down? That you are cursed if you lead a blind person astray. Right, it breaches the love you're to have for other men, especially as God has laid forth over and over again. Who were the kinds of people that Israel was to care for? Orphans, widows, foreigners who were living in the land as resident aliens, those who were unable to care or provide for themselves. And so a blind person would certainly fall under that. When you look down at verse 25, another one of the cursed people under the curses of the covenant. Cursed is he who accepts a bribe to strike down an innocent person. I can think of off the top of my head at least three times we've already seen in Deuteronomy where God has commanded the people, especially their judges and their officials of the law, to not pervert justice, to not accept a bribe because he himself would not do that. And so the people even agree to that. And you might be wondering, okay, well, if this is the curses, where are the bad things that God says will happen? Well, first he's setting up, these are the people who will be accursed or cursed. And then he's going to give those who will, the blessings of the covenant, the ways God will bless you if you are not one of these people. If you do not follow in this kind of a lifestyle or pattern of abuse of others or breach of faith with God, then these will be the good things God will do for you in chapter 28. But then the largest part of chapter 28 from verse 15 through about the end of the chapter is all about the actual things God will do as a punishment. The curses come back into this. And so on either side of the blessings, you have the curses of the covenant and the people who will be cursed by God for breaching faith and breaking the covenant with him. And so the people here at the outset are saying that they agree that these kinds of attitudes or actions will lead them to be in breach of the covenant with God. So later, if they decide that they want to do one of these things, if they think, well, you know, I'm going to trick this blind guy and lead him astray because that'll be really funny, or maybe I can rob him, or whatever other reason they might have to do that, will they be guiltless because they're doing that? And maybe they just forgot that they said amen at Mount Ebal, saying that that person would be cursed. That's why they are going through this. They are signing themselves on, as it were, signing the documents, putting their names next to each of these things, in a sense, saying we will uphold these standards and accept punishment for these kinds of breaches of faith. So in 28, when God, through Moses, starts speaking of the good things he will do if they are careful to keep his covenants and his commandments, in verse 1, it says, "Now it shall be, if you diligently obey the Lord your God, being careful to do all his commandments, which I command you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth. All these blessings will come upon you and overtake you if you obey the Lord your God." And so the blessings he lays out in the first 6 verses have to do with this idea of being exalted above the nations of the earth. So if they are faithful, if they are careful to live according to the blessings, according to the covenant of God, what kinds of blessings does he promise them that will exalt them over the nations here in verses 3 through 6 of Deuteronomy 28?
Children.
Okay, so they'll have children, they'll have offspring. What else will they have? Okay, so they'll have prosperity, they'll have the fruit of the land given to them. In verse 3, what will happen with their cities or with the nation as a whole? Well, it says that you shall be blessed. So the idea here is that they will be given the good things of God, whether on a national or on a city level, or even immediately in their own families. Their bread baskets and their meeting bowls will always be full. They will be able to come in and go out in peace and blessing. So they won't have anything to be concerned about, will they? Is what God is saying here. I'm going to take care of your physical needs, your need for shelter, your need for protection, your need for clothing and for abundance. And not only that, but he promises in verse 7, part of the blessings is that they will become what to their enemies? They'll be this unstoppable force, won't they? It says that the Lord or Yahweh will cause your enemies who rise up against you to be smitten before you. They shall come out against you one way and shall flee before you in 7 ways. So they will have victory in war. Their barns, God describes in verse 8 as being built up and filled. In verse 9, he talks about establishing them as a holy people, as he had sworn to them already, and if they keep his commandments and walk in his ways. And that the people of the earth, verse 10, they will see this, and what will it cause them to do? They'll be afraid of them because they're called by the name of Yahweh, or the name of the Lord. And so it's not just abundance and plenty. It's not just protection against enemies. They will become known as the people who are God's. They are God's people. And so that meant something, didn't it? It wasn't just that you were an Israelite. It meant that you had the best of life. You had the best of what the land had to offer because you were given a law that taught you how to walk and be holy and perfect before your God. And so God was promising them quite a bit, wasn't he? And then the hammer comes down for the rest of the chapter. He says in verse 15, "But it shall come to pass, if you will not listen to the voice of Yahweh your God, to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes that I command you this day, that all these curses shall come upon you and overtake you." So just as the blessings, if they are faithful and keep the commandments of God, would overtake them, so will the curses if they fail. And so he says, "Cursed shall you be in the city, and cursed shall you be in the field. Cursed shall be your basket and your meeting bowl. Cursed shall be the fruit of your body and the fruit of your ground, the increase of your cattle and the young of the flock. Cursed shall you be when you come in, and cursed shall you be when you go out." So what really are the curses of the covenant based on what the opening curses are here? Is it just God coming up with whatever punishment he can think of at the time?
Basically the opposite of the blessings that they have.
It's a complete reversal of every good thing he promises them. So he promised them that they would have bread in their basket and their meeting bowl would be full. And so he curses it and says, it'll be empty if you fail. And so this really shows us the opposite side of the coin, as it were. That all of these good things he's promising them were not theirs to keep. They were the reward of faithful living. And so, just as they were the reward, he would reverse them and they would become the punishments. And I think if you remember back to our Minor Prophets class at the beginning of this year, do you remember how often this was the case? That they would complain about, we don't have food or our cattle are dying. And the prophets were saying, because you're not keeping the covenant. And if you keep the covenant, all of these things will be reversed.
Josh.
Yes.
Notice in verse 14, gives them that reminder again right before that. Do not turn aside from any of the words which I command you today, to the right or to the left, and go after other gods to serve them.
Yes.
He gives them that again and again and tells them that don't turn from the right or left. You stay the course. Don't worship these gods. But of course, you know, they did. They have leaders that led them, you know, to
right. And so from the leadership, especially that the people would have, you kind of have the signs of whether or not the people will be faithful. If the leader's not faithful, oftentimes the people as a nation were not, though there were still faithful people in the land, even in the land of Israel, even though in Elijah's time at one point he thought, I'm the only one left. In Deuteronomy 28, and we're going to look at verse, let's look down here. We're going to jump forward a little bit to verse 47. So here in verse 47 of Deuteronomy 28, we have again this future prediction of the people's faithlessness. And so God says here through Moses, because you did not serve the Lord your God with joy and a glad heart for the abundance of all things, therefore you shall serve your enemies whom the Lord will send against you, in hunger, in thirst, in nakedness, and in the lack of all things. And he will put an iron yoke on your neck until he has destroyed you. The Lord will bring a nation against you from afar, from the end of the earth, as the eagle swoops down, a nation whose language you shall not understand, a nation of fierce countenance, who will have no respect for the old, nor show favor to the young. So here, God makes it clear one of the things that motivates them to not keep the covenant, to bring these curses upon themselves. What's one of the root causes of failure to keep the covenant for the people? Okay, so one of the things is learning from the nation something that has already been told them multiple times in Deuteronomy not to do, because it would lead them to worship and follow other gods. And why would they feel the need to go after these other gods? I think verse 47 shows us part of the reason behind that. Because they're not really serving the Lord. Because they serve him without joy, without a glad heart. Because they have the abundance that he's promised in the blessings. And how do they treat the blessings? They're not thankful for them. Because where do they think the blessings are coming from? Right. Just like we can do that. When things are going well in our life and we are being blessed by God, we can sometimes start thinking, hey, look at how good I am and what I've built for myself. And over again in Scripture, when someone has that attitude, that's usually right about the time that God comes in and knocks their feet out from under them to teach them to be humble before him. One extreme example of that is King Nebuchadnezzar. He's standing in his balcony. He's looking out over Babylon when it was in its height of power. And he goes, look at what I've built for myself. And then he spent a few years like an animal, like a madman eating grass out in the wilderness until he came to himself and realized that it had been God who had given him the things that he had. And then God restored him to his position of power as king over Babylon. Austin?
The problem that they had before, even in battle, he kind of put in here, God told him, no, you have too much men. You have too many men. Right? Because he knew what would happen if they brought a lot of men and won the battle. They think it was them.
Right. Putting faith in themselves and in their own numbers and thinking that they had won in battle. For example, Gideon, like you were referring to, is a perfect example of that. That God says, you have too many people. You're going to think you did it yourself. And so he gets him down to 300 against a few hundred thousand as a conservative estimate of the people that he fought there in the book of Judges. So part of this is a lack of thankfulness, of not truly serving God, of believing that they have given themselves the things that they have. And so God, as a punishment then, is going to make them serve these nations around them. And he uses the example of a nation who comes from afar, who swoops down like an eagle, whose language they don't understand, and who has no respect for whether you were old or young. What does that sound like that we know happens later to Israel?
Captivities.
Right, the captivity. In fact, Babylon, one of the ways that in the prophets God refers to them coming is like a swooping eagle. And so all the way in Deuteronomy, way before you have even the kings or the divided kingdom or the prophets writing their books, what is God already telling the people is going to happen? I'm going to bring a nation against you when you fail as punishment, and they are going to take you away. And all of this comes down to, as verse 58 says, if you are not careful to observe all the words of this law which are written in this book, to fear this honored and awesome name, Yahweh your God, then Yahweh will bring extraordinary plagues on you and your descendants, even severe and lasting plagues, and miserable and chronic sicknesses. And so here, he brings in not only the fact that they need to be careful in observing all of the law, not just the things maybe that are easier, that they like, or things that they feel that they can do without having to change themselves. He warns about bringing plagues upon them. And he starts talking about Egypt and the plagues that he brought upon them. And so even in the covenant that God makes in Deuteronomy, he's making the same promises that he made to Pharaoh, that he would do these different plagues to them to teach Pharaoh and the people that there is one God. Well, he says, if you don't keep my commandments, if you don't live according to the things I've told you, I'm going to bring those things upon you as well. And to varying degrees, God does bring plagues and sickness upon his people many times to teach them through discipline to return to him. And so he says in verse 64 that the Lord's going to scatter them among all peoples from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth. And there you shall serve other gods, wood and stone, which you and your fathers have not known. And so the ultimate punishment of the law, the ultimate curse, is that the people will get what they wanted the whole time they were in the land. They're there in the land receiving the blessings of God. And so then they turn to serve other gods. And Yahweh says, fine, go and serve those other gods in their lands as prisoners and captives. And so he promises to scatter them and let them serve those gods and see how things go for them in a sense. And these are the words, chapter 29, verse 1 says, of the covenant which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the sons of Israel in the land of Moab, besides the covenant which he had made with them at Horeb. And so some versions of the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Bible, the first verse of 29 goes along with their chapter 28. And in the English Bibles and the Christian Bibles, they put it with the beginning of chapter 29. And really what we have here is the conclusion of the giving of the law or of the curses or of any of these things in a very direct manner. And after this, Moses is going to pick up speaking on a personal note to the people before he gives up his life, as it were, by going with the Lord up onto Mount Pisgah. And so we're told here, this is the second time they've been given this covenant. The first time was at Horeb or Mount Sinai, and what we would probably refer to as the end of Exodus and most of Leviticus contains that version of the covenant. And this version, Deuteronomy, the second giving of the law, was what was given to them in the land of Moab before they entered into the land. And so really, the giving of the covenant bookends the time of the people as they wander in the wilderness and prepare to enter into God's land that he's promised them. And so ultimately, what 27 and 28 are showing us is that there is great reward in keeping God's law, and there's to be great terror in the idea of having the curses of disobedience fall upon you as God's people. And so this was to be the final kind of push to get the people to see this is serious and this is something that you must decide upon. And Moses is going to take it upon himself in chapter 29 to really drive that message home for the people. He urges them in the first nine verses of chapter 29 to remember what it had been like in following him in his leadership in the wilderness. He speaks about the fact that they had seen in verse 2 all that the Lord did before your eyes in the land of Egypt to Pharaoh and all his servants and all his land. Why would he start with that right after giving them the curses and the blessings of the covenant? Were the curses real for them in this moment when they're agreeing to these things? No, they're all in the future and it's all hypothetical, so we don't need to worry about those things, right? So what was the only real thing that Moses could get them to latch on to, John?
Is this the next generation?
This would be the sons of that first generation, but most of them would have been fairly young and had witnessed these things, yes, that happened in Egypt. They would have been children, though, most likely, when they saw them. And now they're well into adulthood with children of their own. They'd probably be in their 30s and 40s by this point. Some maybe even older. Joshua and Caleb would have been the oldest people after Moses. They would have been in their around 80 at this point.
The point you're getting at is they should remember because they had seen the power of God in those acts.
Right. Right. They had seen all of these things happen over the course of their life. And so for them, they had already seen some of the blessings of God enacted and some of the curses of God put upon their enemies, right? And so Moses is saying, don't forget these things. Don't forget about them, because if you forget about them, then what are they going to think about these promised blessings and curses? Well, they're not really real, right? Until they're already happening to you, especially the curses. Those are just, well, that's just, you know, he's just telling us, be careful. That could become their attitude very easily. And so he's reminding them of the things that God had done for them as he had led them as God's leader of the people. In verse 10, he tells them, you stand today, all of you, before the Lord your God, your chiefs, your tribes, your elders, and your officers, even all the men of Israel. your little ones, your wives, and the alien who is within your camps, from the one who chops your wood to the one who draws your water, that you may enter into the covenant with the Lord your God and into his oath, which the Lord your God is making with you today, in order that he may establish you today as his people and that he may be your God, just as he spoke to you and as he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so he's telling them, this is your decision now. I'm not going to make it for you, is the way you could say he's putting this. He says, not with you alone am I making this covenant. So he says, this isn't between you and me. Who is this covenant? Who is this oath between?
Israel and God.
Because if it's between Israel and Moses, well, when Moses is dead, what are they going to think? Well, that's done. Right. That's done because he's dead, so we're free from it. And so he makes it clear to them, this is between you and the eternal God. This is between you and him, the one who brought you out of Egypt, who promised to your forefathers to give you this land, to make you a nation. And so he was warning them really to be careful about treating this covenant lightly. He says in verse 22 of chapter 29, "Now the generation to come, your sons who rise up after you and the foreigner who comes from a distant land, when they see the plagues of the land and the diseases with which the Lord has afflicted it, will say, all its land is brimstone and salt, a burning waste, unsown and unproductive, and no grass grows in it. Like the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah." So what is it that Moses is saying has already happened at this point when he's talking about in this future group of people that comes up? Terry?
I'm not going to answer your question directly, but you know what I, you were asking earlier a little bit about the people and where they go. I think that we become very complacent, and we do as well today. And we see in our generation a group of people that, you know, we forget about the curses or the don'ts, and we look at the blessings only, and we see a lot of our TV evangelists, what I'm trying to say, that are really promoting only the blessings that God might provide, and we forget that God said, if you do these other, you don't get these blessings. And I think as human beings, we become complacent, because when God's been good to us, he's really not going to do those things to us that he said he would, because God's good. And you kind of wonder if maybe they don't even fall. That's human nature, it seems to be. But let's look at the blessings of God, not at the cursings of God. And then these people, you know, they tend to forget about what God told them. And they gradually begin to move loose. They no longer focus on God, I guess, and begin to focus on their own selfish desires.
Right. And so when that's the case, when the people are forgetting the Lord because they're focusing on the blessings or on their own desires, what Moses is setting up here is, once that's happened, if you let that happen, then the generation that comes after you, your children, the people who come from other nations to be a part of Israel because of the blessings that God has given to it, they're going to come to the land, and what are they going to see? A land that looks like Sodom and Gomorrah when God wiped it off the face of the earth. It's going to be a land of plagues and disease with nothing growing in it. And what is that going to make the people do? Well, they're going to ask a question. In verse 24, all the nations are going to say, "Why has the Lord done thus to this land? Why this great outburst of anger?" Well, the answer is given in verse 25. That they will say, because they forsook the covenant of the Lord, the God of their fathers, which he made with them when he brought them out of the land of Egypt. And so he talks about that they went to serve other gods and worshiped those gods. And that is why the anger of the Lord burned against them and against that land. And so ultimately what Moses is warning them of is that this is a serious thing. This isn't make-believe. This isn't, you know, oh, well, we don't have to worry about the consequences. This is something that will befall you and your children if you are not careful. And so going into chapter 30, Moses starts speaking about the promised restoration that God offers. That God, even in all of this, leaves room for the people to return to a place of compassion from him. He talks about in verse 3 that after they've been banished into the nations and have suffered the plagues, that then the Lord your God will restore you from captivity. This being only after, as verse 2 tells them, that they return to the Lord and obey him again with all of their heart and soul, according to all that I commanded you today, you and your sons. And so this isn't just God saying, if you're not careful, I'm just going to blast you off the face of the earth and we're done. Because that's never been God's character. That's not who God is. He is still a merciful and loving God, and he leaves room then for repentance of his people, doesn't he? And so Moses tells them at the end of this chapter, in verses 15 through the end of the chapter, he puts it in this way for them. See, I have set before you this day life and good and death and evil. And that I command you this day to love Yahweh your God, to walk in his ways, and to keep his commandments and his statutes and his ordinances, that you may live and multiply, and that Yahweh your God may bless you in the land into which you are going to possess it. And so he puts it in very black and white terms. This is a choice between life and the good, the blessings of God, or death and evil. That makes this a lot easier of a choice, doesn't it? Because it can get very overwhelming. You think about all of the things they've been told that they need to do and all of the curses that will come upon them and all of the blessings they will receive if they are faithful. And it could just almost lose you. And Moses boils it down into this simple black and white choice, doesn't he? Choose the life that God is offering you or choose death as punishment. And so he's calling for them at the end of the chapter. He says, down in verse, let's see here, I lost my place. Verse 19, I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have set before you life and death, the blessings and the curse. So choose life in order that you may live, you and your descendants, by loving the Lord your God, by obeying his voice, and by holding fast to him. For this is your life and the length of your days, that you may live in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give them. And so Moses' final advice is do the covenant. Keep the word that God has given you because it's your life. And if you treated God's law in that way, as if it was your very life to keep these commandments, doesn't that make them not seem like a burden? If this is your life, if it's your manner of life, the way you see the world, the way you interact with other people, it's not just God saying, don't do this and don't do that. And by the way, if you do that, I'm going to punish you. It becomes your very character and morality. And ultimately, that's what the law always was supposed to be for the people. It was to teach them and make them a holy people before the Lord. So we're running out of time to get through the rest of the chapters as detailed as we've been going through these. In the 31st chapter, Moses gives the people his final counsel, and then he transitions leadership over to Joshua. And God speaks with Joshua and Moses in this chapter. He gives them commissions calling for them to be strong and courageous, to do the will of God as they enter the land, to keep his covenant and his law. And then chapter 32, which if you haven't read it, you really need to go back and read this chapter. Because it gives you a summation of everything that we've been talking about in this whole class. Because it is a song that God commands Moses to write down and teach the people to sing as a witness against them. And so what this song teaches the people is who they are and who their God is, their relationship with him at the beginning of the song. But not only that, that he's a faithful God and that they are a faithless people, that they are going to become proud and arrogant. And he uses a name called Jeshurun, or Yeshurun, depending on the translation. And he describes them in verse 15 like being a fat and kicking animal who's grown fat and sleek and thick, and because of that, they don't want to obey the Lord. And so that leads ultimately to God sending punishment against his people in a just fashion, seeking vengeance for himself. In verse 35, vengeance is mine and retribution in due time, for their foot will slip, for the day of their calamity is near, and the impending things are hastening upon them. And so this song is taught to the people, and they are told to pass it down to their sons and to the next generation after them as a witness or as a claim against the people, so that when God punishes them, they can't say, but we didn't know better, or this is unfair. And that's the whole purpose of the witnesses at the end of the book of Deuteronomy, to show the justice of God in punishing the people for breaching the covenant. The end of the book in chapter 33 is Moses giving blessings to the people. He speaks blessings over different ones of the tribe, of the different tribes, and the things that he wants for them. And he ends it at the end of the offering of blessings with a hymn of praise or a prayer for Israel and for God. And then in chapter 34, we'll end the book with the last minute of class. Moses is called up to Mount Pisgah. He goes there and he views all of the land that God is going to give his people. He sees from Gilead, where Dan would be, all the way to the south where the Negev is, and where Jerusalem and Jericho and all these places are, because he is not allowed to enter the land because of his sin against God. And that's where he dies, is there on the mountain, and he's buried by the Lord so that the people won't know where he is, and no one knows where his burial is, even to this day. And Joshua is filled with the spirit of wisdom, or the spirit of God, and he goes then to lead the people after a 30-day period of mourning for the death of Moses after his 120 years. And what's interesting is in verse 7, it describes Moses there at the end of his life, that his eye was not dim and his vigor had not abated him. And I don't know if some of you have ever had a grandparent or someone who lived to be 100 or close to 100. I had a great-grandmother live to 95, and she was not anything like what Moses is described as. And so ultimately, he lost his life because it was time to enter the land. And so I hope Deuteronomy has been helpful for you. Next Sunday, we'll begin the first chapter of our study in the book, Mind Your King, which, if you don't have your copy, is in the back there by the bulletins.